From WBEZ Chicago and PRX, this is Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. This week we talk with Susan Jacobs, the music supervisor for HBO's Sharp Objects. It's her job to pick songs that elevate the visuals to another level.
It's always about what's conveying the emotion that the director wants to convey. As you know, I always tell people music is a point of view. Our job as supervisors is to make sure that everybody's understanding the different points of view that are possible.
Plus, we'll review new albums from Prince and singer-songwriter Sam Phillips.
That's all coming up on Sound Opinions. You're listening to Sound Opinions, and later in the show, Jim, we're going to talk with Susan Jacobs. She's an Emmy-winning music supervisor. That means she's the person that picks the songs you hear in shows like Sharp Objects and Big Little Lies. She's also been the music supervisor for a number of movies, working with people like Spike Lee, David O. Russell, on and on. She'll talk with us about how she decides what's the perfect song for every scene and how she got Led Zeppelin, of all people, to agree to their music being used.
That's coming up later in the show, Greg. But first, we've got some new music.
Never meant to cause you any sorrow. Never meant to cause you pain. No one of my time see you laughing.
That is a snippet of Purple Rain. Everybody knows that song, right?
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
The great Prince. As you can tell, a very sparse, stripped-down version in its initial stages of Purple Rain. These are demo recordings done in Prince's house before there was a Paisley Park, even.
Yeah.
Sitting at a piano with a microphone and working out songs. And that's the name of the new posthumous Prince album, Piano and a Microphone, 1983. What a career he's had since his death in 2016. The vaults have become open to the public. We'll see what this produces, because in the past we've seen some vault projects, the Jimi Hendrix estate, the Doors, etc., since Jim Morrison's death, where there's been a ton of recordings coming out posthumously. That is starting to happen now with Prince's music as well. We're going to evaluate the merits of this project, but first, let's play a track from it. It's a track called Mary, Don't You Weep, the great 19th century spiritual mm-hmm. that has been in the gospel canon for centuries, as performed by Prince from Piano and a Microphone, 1983, on Sound Opinions.
That is Prince with a piano and a microphone in 1983, covering Mary, Don't You Weep. I don't think he tops Aretha Franklin's version on Amazing Grace, but it is an extraordinary version of that song, Greg. You neglected to say it was recorded by an engineer, this album, Piano and a Microphone, 1983, on cassette. Mm. And at one point, you can hear Prince talking about, you got to flip that over now, right? Cassette, kids, was an antiquated technology. Oh, never mind. You know, I am saddened by what is certain to be 40 or 50 years of posthumous grave robbing of Prince's vaults. Would he have released this? I don't know. Is there interest there for people who love Prince? Absolutely. You know, the stakes are not high. He's playing for the joy of playing. You can see songs develop. You can see sides of his personality, as with Mary, Don't You Weep. I also really love the unreleased song Cold Coffee and Cocaine.
Last time, baby, I eat over your place. That's all I get. Just a cup of cold coffee, cocaine, your ugly face. Look out.
Prince heads talk about his Jamie Starr character, right? You know, the street hustler, the wiser. You know, all right. You know, Mary and Cold Coffee and Cocaine are the only revelations here. This is not a great lost Prince album like, say, the Black Album, the hard funk record he had to shelve in 1987. We all scoffed it up on bootlegs, didn't come out officially till 1994. Are there equivalents like that in these vaults? I don't know. There are revelations here. I just don't know if I'll ever listen to it again.
You know, I disagree with the I'll never listen to it again remark. I mean, that's your taste. My initial reaction to this record was that it was kind of a throwaway. Okay, what's this all about? Why is this even coming out? And the more I listened to it, I sort of got pulled into the idea that we're getting a window into process here. And we so seldom got that with Prince. You know, he was very big on releasing finished records. In fact, there's tons of finished records in his vaults that haven't come out. So why this one? He hadn't made Purple Rain yet.
Right.
You know, he's on the cusp of something really extraordinary, but we're seeing how his mind works. And what I loved most about hearing this is his virtuosity as a pianist, first of all, and the joy he brings to the performances. The fact that he seems to be so unfiltered and realizing, hey, I'm just sort of messing around here, just following my mind, letting it wander, is pretty fascinating. I mean, there's basically a 30-minute string of unbroken music here where he's just flowing one piece into the next. You know, a snippet of Purple Rain, a snippet of Joni Mitchell.
In my body like a holy wine, so bitter.
That great gospel track that we just played, which, by the way, he totally reinvents.
Yeah, it goes somewhere. He takes it out of church.
There's no
he
biblical
takes it to Saturday night.
The biblical scripture isn't there anymore. And Mary's now a real person who's, your lover's not going to come home, Mary.
Right.
Mary, don't you weep, you know. He's talking about some other subjects there. He's blending the sacred and the profane.
Mama, don't you move. Got a bad, bad feeling. Your man ain't coming home.
So I love that aspect. And I'm glad you mentioned Cold Coffee and Cocaine. You know, Jamie Starr is just another way of saying, I'm ripping off James Brown here. Now, I'm not going to recommend this to everybody. But, man, if you're a Prince fan, this is manna from heaven, as the man might say.
Yeah, but if somebody spent 2 years and went through what is alleged to be, you know, a treasure trove in the vault and just found those Mary Don't You Weeps and gave us a whole album of that, you know, instead this is going to be, you know, he's going to be putting out records, you know, longer than he was alive.
No doubt about it. There's going to be hundreds of Prince records before we're all gone.
Our mistakes have made us, they say we're made of stars. I spent all my disbelief on you and how far. We made it before it all came apart. It's amazing what a girl can do with half a heart.
Greg, that is a little bit of a song called World on Sticks, the title track of the 10th album by Sam Phillips, her first record in 5 years. Sam Phillips has had a fascinating life and career. Began writing songs as a teenager and came to the world as a Christian artist in the mid-80s. In the late 80s and the early 90s, she left that world behind, but not her religion. She's always been fascinated in philosophy and in fundamentalism. She hooked up with and married T-Bone Burnett, the great producer. And we got a string of really beloved albums, The Indescribable Wow, Cruel Inventions, Martinis and Bikinis, wonderful power pop records. So that's the second phase of her career. I would say she had a third phase in the early 2000s, recording for Nonesuch Records, dabbling with a lot of different styles. And now, after 5 years silence, she is back with World on Sticks. She has long been a songwriter's songwriter. Dare I say, almost Leonard Cohen-like in her acid wit, and merging that, though, with these beautiful melodies at the best throughout her canon. All of that means nothing to many of our younger listeners who will now jump up and down when I say she also did the La 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 song in the Gilmore Girls. I think there's a whole generation of people who only know that and probably didn't even know her name.
Mm-hmm.
So Leslie Phillips rechristened herself Sam because it was a childhood nickname. What is she giving us on her latest album? Here is a track called How Much Is Enough by Sam Phillips on Sound Opinions.
Someone keeps giving out the wrong numbers. We're not supposed to know what's true. Champagne promises. Only red, only blue. When they break down the doors to Easy Street, will they leave anything for you? How much is enough? How much is enough? How much is enough? I need more of the sky, more breath and sea. More of nothing to lose. Information chase, try to get you with headlines. Which attentions to choose? Take me behind the screen, and I'll watch you play the news. How much is enough? How much is enough? How much is enough?
That is How Much Is Enough from Sam Phillips' new record, World on Sticks. Sam Phillips doesn't release a lot of music in the last few decades, Jim. She's been very sparse with the amount of recordings she's put out. But I would say each one of those is very carefully considered and is a small gem in its own right. And I would put this record in that category. You know, that question, how much is enough? There's a lot of questions on this record. Where will we live when they've conquered the earth? When they break down the doors to Easy Street, will they leave anything for you?
This is her apocalyptic
yes,
record.
Yes, this is about, you know, we're on the precipice of an ecological disaster, and she is going to, you know, remind us of the fact that we are in a fragile place right now as a world. Our world on sticks, so brave, so small. It's a key line in the record from the title track. And at the same time, you're going, man, this sounds really oppressive. I mean, it sounds like I'm being lectured to, or what is this going to be? But the music, she approaches the music with a light touch. You know, she's got a great group of musicians that love to work with her, especially that drummer, Jay Bellrose. He's an incredible drummer. I think the orchestral feel he brings to his drumming to accompany the songs. And she also plays with a small string section, the section quartet, in fact, they're called, that bring a real bite to their parts. It's not just mushy and soft. And that's very a very nice counterpoint to the way Phillips writes songs. You know, you always get a hook or a phrase or a little surprise in there that sort of sticks with you long after the song is done. These are very, very sharply etched songs. There's not a wasted note on the record. You know, you mentioned that she's a songwriter's songwriter, and I think once again, she's made the case on this record.
I know you're a super fan, and I am not in a particularly grouchy mood today. I just want you to know I'm hugely disappointed by this record.
Hugely disappointed.
Hugely disappointed. I'm a huge Sam Phillips fan, especially that 90s period of power pop effervescence. What she is doing here seems to me way too Tom Waits wannabe, in the sense of I am an eccentric who will now dabble in Brecht vile cabaret.
They're building their dreams, the American landfill kings. The American landfill
key. I hate that. All right, that's what I hate about Tom Waits. I disagree with you about the drumming. I think it's way over the top. It's distracting. The strings bug me. Veering between this cabaret and this sort of Ennio Morricone thing at times, I just don't think the music is up to the lyrics, which, as always, are excellent. I would have preferred to hear these songs in much more stripped-down fashion, which is what she gave us on the Nonesuch records, or in her pop mode. There are two pop gems, Tears in the Ground and How Much Is Enough. And the rest of the album, I ain't going there with her.
I've been having nightmares like you wouldn't believe, all day long until I fall asleep.
But as always, we want to hear from you. Call and leave a message on our hotline, 888-859-1800. Give us your opinions on either of these albums. Or find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Coming up, we talk with music supervisor Susan Jacobs about her work on the HBO series Sharp Objects and Big Little Lies. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. That guy over there is Greg Kot. And this week, our guest is Emmy-winning music supervisor Susan Jacobs. Her job as music supervisor is to carefully choose tracks for film and television that elevate the visuals to a new level beyond what's written on the page or shown on screen. Let me just name, Greg, a few of the movies Susan's worked on. She's Gotta Have It, Kansas City, Basquiat, Capote, Little Miss Sunshine, Silver Linings Playbook, American Hustle, I, Tonya. Really love that one. And we're talking about directors that range from David O. Russell to Spike Lee, Robert Altman to M. Night Shyamalan. But her latest project was doing the music for the HBO miniseries Sharp Objects.
When you're here, you're my daughter. Everything you do comes back on me.
I didn't come back to cause any problems.
I can tell. You hate this place like me.
Someone in this town's hiding something.
Mama says I need to be careful around you. Is that true? Are you dangerous?
That's right, Jim. This is her second television collaboration with director Jean-Marc Vallier after the HBO series Big Little Lies. So we began the interview by asking her how she got into the music supervision business.
You know, I got my start sort of falling, like I think most things, I fell backwards into this field. You know, my first soundtrack album credit was project managing She's Gotta Have It, and worked very closely with Spike Lee's father, who did the score for that album when I was working at Island Records.
There's a girl that I once knew who often had a friend or two. She gave them time, love, wit, and rhyme sublime. They would come from far away and often gather there all day to show their love and see which one would stay.
And then I went on to management. I kind of circled around this for a long time in different directions. And by the time that I actually knew there was such a job as music supervision, which came from a recommendation to Julian Schnabel for Basquiat, that was the first film I ever did on my own. You know, I approached it like, this is what my artist wants, Julian. This is what he wants, and I'm going to figure out a way to get all this music.
You know, Susan, your job essentially didn't exist for a long time. I mean, it was one of those things that sort of evolved as music and movies developed this sort of synergistic relationship. It used to be that orchestral scores made for these movies, right? And then the job also became not only these original scores, but then the idea of placing songs from the pop music realm or whatever genre into the movie to sort of help develop character, tone, and plot. Were you kind of a fan of this art form before you actually started doing it?
Yeah, I used to actually play soundtrack albums. I was addicted to The Swimmer, the soundtrack The Swimmer that had the most beautiful Marvin Hamlisch theme. You know, and Spartacus, and I think my record collection had almost equally vinyl soundtracks as it did bands. Mm-hmm. You know, I've always found that interesting, and I, you know, never in a million years thought about it as a job. I didn't know that it was a job. And even when I came in, really a lot of supervisors were working directly with record labels and then putting their music into moving, where record labels are actually paying for for supervisors and the music in the movies. You know, I'm just such a control freak in the fact that I don't want to be dictated backwards, but I really just always wanted the freedom to, you know, go wherever the movie and the director wanted to go and then end up having people bid on the soundtrack after that and not kind of work it in the other way, because I just, the being dictated to from that direction was never interesting to me.
I think where it's evolved too is that it's become a much more important factor in television. And now that you've got these miniseries that are sort of viewed as art forms on the level of a great movie, you've got this increasingly important role that music is playing in them. What intrigued you about these miniseries?
Well, my only experience, I followed my director. You know, Jean-Marc Vallier and I had worked on a couple of feature films, and he said, okay, we're going here. And that was my deep dive, and came away with so much appreciation for that work.
What do you look at in the ocean? What's out there?
It's full of life. Dreams. Mystery.
Monsters?
Who knows what lies out there beneath the surface?
You know, something I really liked about the two HBO series you worked on, Big Little Lies and Sharp Objects, was that they both featured female music geeks. You know, I think too often in movies and TV, male characters are the ones who are the messengers of the cool music, you know, the ones whose lives are saved by rock and roll. First, I want to talk about Chloe from Big Little Lies, who's this little six-year-old girl who loves music, and we're not talking about Disney songs. You know, she is listening to some pretty great stuff. Mm. PJ Harvey, Charles Bradley.
She's amazing. I mean, Chloe with her precocious little iPod, you know, telling her dad, you know, which Elvis song he needs to play. No, dad, you got to do this one. You know, she's already hanging out with the old 70s stuff and then, you know, introducing Leon Bridges to her mom. And, you know, she's an incredibly precocious young girl.
Can you not want to make up on this song? Come on.
Been traveling these wide roads for so long. My heart's been full.
This is a beautiful song, honey.
10,000 miles gone. Take me to your river.
Which, you know, is very much how Jean-Marc planned it, because he doesn't use composers, so we are having to tell our emotive story through the licensed tracks, which is very unusual for any director to kind of know that going through, that I'm not going to use a composer and we're going to handle all these emotional beats through our, you know, through these characters. Mm. That's a, I mean, so Chloe, you know, was really, she's the one that sort of was helping everybody narratively through her iPod tell that story.
Well, there's also a character in Sharp Objects, Alice, who helps tell the narrative with music on her iPod. She's a fellow patient in the hospital with Camille, the show's protagonist. They were both dealing with problems with self-harm. Alice teaches Camille to use music, particularly Led Zeppelin, as a way to escape the internal distress, the pain that she's experiencing.
What I loved about Camille was that she didn't know anything about music. She gets into the hospital and she's there with this young girl that, you know, kind of looks at her and says, "What kind of music do you play or do you listen to?" And she's like, I don't like music. I never really listened to music." And the girl's like, jaw just falls on
yeah,
the floor.
Can't believe that.
And she's like, "What? No wonder you're in here, girl." And she's like, "Well, you're in here too, girl." And she goes, "But I can get out of here."
Yeah.
And that, I love that so much, that she could teach somebody older than her. She's a teenager looking at somebody in her mid-20s and saying, "I can teach you how to fly out of here. You don't even have to be in here."
Mm.
And teaching the power of music to escape your situations. I think that's what Led Zeppelin, you know, really signed on to, was that music is a lot more than just some background thing in a restaurant or some pop act or some video. It plays a hugely important role in so many lives. And if you're not familiar with it in that way and don't have that relationship, I'm hoping that Camille's character encourages everybody to kind of sit back and go, "Wait, I'm in this mood. I'm going to put on this record and see what happens."
Mm-hmm.
And you can fly off, and it will totally change your mood. I think that's the importance of it.
I guess the wind says, "Finn, sail away, leave the day way up high in the sky. And low, but the wind won't blow. We really shouldn't go. We got only enough to share.
Well, you know, I got to ask you, though, Susan, so did you ever have a conversation with the Alice character and say, "Why do you have such expensive taste? Because licensing Led Zeppelin songs ain't cheap." I wondered how that worked out, because they're notoriously difficult to, you know, extract music from or allow their music to be used in films or TV shows.
You know, when Jean-Marc knew that Led Zeppelin was his fantasy to be able to use it, I don't know if he ever thought this would really happen, but he put it in my hands and said, if I could find anything for Alice and Camille, this would be what it was. And I started working on that way before we started shooting. And we started the really early conversations and working with a wonderful woman over at Warner Chappell. You know, we just kept shaping the letters and the communication until it became really clear that, you know, when you look at episode 3 and you have that scene where Camille then turns around and also shares, you know, helps young Alice in a painful moment, going, "Come on, let's get out of here."
Mm-hmm.
And she puts on "Thank You."
If the sun refused to shine, I would still be loving you. When mountains crumble to the sea, there will still be you and me.
Any artist is going to go, "That's why I spend all this time writing and making music," which isn't easy. And I think that's not like you could go to Led Zeppelin and go, "Here, let me give you like this huge check so we can do whatever we want," because it's never going to be about that for any artist. It's always going to be like, how do you want it? I'm sure there are a lot of commercials that offer Led Zeppelin more money than they could imagine, and they go, "Nope, thank you."
Yeah.
I mean, it really is about those artists looking at the way that this music is affecting these characters and the way that Jean-Marc takes such good care of music in terms of its authenticity, about where it's coming from, and feeling like, okay, and you know, for them, it's super smart because the demographics of the show, a lot of them have never heard these songs.
Yeah.
So they're so smart because this aerates their catalog and it helps people find them. But more importantly, it helps people realize the power of what their music can do in a painful moment. And so it wasn't really, you know, people think like the difficulty was just having a lot of patience and trying to put across why this was really important. And they one day they just got it.
When we return, music supervisor Susan Jacobs tells us more about selecting the soundtrack to the HBO shows Big Little Lies and Sharp Objects. She's also going to tell the story of putting together music for the film I, Tanya during a chaotic production period. Plus, Jim, you're going to take a trip to the desert island. What are you going to do there?
Greg, I have been particularly inspired talking to Susan Jacobs. I've got a song that is key to like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 movies.
Wow. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot. He's Jim DeRogatis. And this week we're talking with music supervisor Susan Jacobs. In 2017, Jacobs won the first ever Emmy for music supervision for her work on the HBO miniseries Big Little Lies, directed by Jean-Marc Vallier. In that show in particular, Jacobs profiled a lot of new artists. And in many ways, I think music supervisors are the new talent scouts in the music world because they're introducing millions of people to relatively unknown artists. I'm thinking of somebody like Michael Kiwanuka, whose song Cold Little Heart was a theme song to Big Little Lies. And I know. In this curation thing, it's not about whether the song is popular or not. Obviously, Led Zeppelin has a certain cachet. Michael Kiwanuka does not, for a mainstream audience, certainly. So are you kind of feeling like, oh, I don't care about cachet as much as I care about what the song is saying and how it's going to work for this scene or this character or this show?
Yeah, it's always what's going to convey the emotion that you want. Michael Kiwanuka was actually in Big Little Lies and kind of fell upwards. So that was what was such an interesting discovery, was that it was sort of in a scene already and then it fell upwards into that title. But when you look at the power of what that has done for his career, and Leon Bridges' career just went right back up on the charts, and then you've got somebody like Sylvain Esso would come down.
Hey, mama, will you come down? Hey, mama, won't you come down to the river to wait, to be?
And the acid with Tumbling Lights. It's really exciting, and I also think that's the power of how Jean-Marc uses the music, because it's emotional. It isn't just, you know, it's really, he's a painter, he's a weaver, you know, he uses little bits of it here and there, so you hear the Sylvain Esso come down at the very beginning with them roller skating, it's really cool, but then it will keep coming around and around, and it hits that beat so that people really feel like they have a relationship with that song by the time we get to the end of the series. I think that's what, to me, makes a big difference about how it is. And it's always about what's conveying the emotion that the director wants to convey. As you know, I always tell people, music is a point of view. Our job as supervisors is to make sure that everybody's understanding the different points of view that are possible. And for someone like Jean-Marc, it's really working backwards from where he's trying to go with the characters, because he's this is how he, this is him, you know, I'm working with him more in the composer capacity. This is what we need to do here and where we're going here. And he's very clear about the emotions of what he wants to do. And there's nothing is in there casually.
I want to talk some more about your work in movies. You did the music for I, Tonya, that 2017 film that Craig Gillespie made about Tonya Harding, controversial figure skater.
The haters always say, Tonya, tell the truth.
Tonya.
There's no such thing as truth. Everyone has their own truth.
Now, do you ever feel constricted by the time periods that you have to pick music from? Because although I, Tonya takes place in the 80s and the 90s, the soundtrack's almost entirely 70s hard rock. Why was that?
Well, I, Tonya was a film that I came in fairly late on, and it was a film that Craig had cut his film using a lot of source music, and those songs tend to be really expensive, but also nobody wanted to be in that movie, I have to tell you. Like, nobody. So when I walked in the door, kind of more as like, we're hemorrhaging over here and we don't know how to save this film. And I was super busy and going, oh my gosh. And I looked at the movie and I thought it was really good. The first thing I realized was that we have to change the narrative about what people think about Tonya Harding. Mm-hmm. And to do that and to, you know, try and flip that around. And so he had already known that he wanted to use a lot of 70s music, which was a little odd because it really doesn't have anything to do with that period, that time, that, you know, Tonya Harding didn't happen in the 70s. I mean, so.
Yeah, but that's kind of what formed her, right?
Well, you could say that, but it really for Craig, you know, this goes down to the power of music and film, was that when I said to Craig, why all the 70s music? And there was a lot of homages already to American Hustle. I was like, mm-hmm. Wow, that was already featured in American Hustle or this or that, which I love, you know, and David O. Russell does too. You know, he said, you know, when you influence other directors, it's amazing. And he was like, well, there's something really emotional and warm about those rock songs in the 70s.
You're in my way.
Who's that?
We met at an ice rink where I was practicing.
When you sit down and try and temp in 80s and 90s, you're right. You don't have the warmth of the scope of the sound of the 70s. So it really started with the picture. Picture first. Picture is always first. What's going to serve the picture? And so those songs ended up really being something about, it was so important on I, Tonya that music stayed warm and that she, so that we could, and had power, because otherwise you wouldn't like her. And if I tried a couple of 90s things and I tried a couple of 80 things and it was totally, film didn't want it and it made her colder. So we really had, we worked really hard. So he already had, you know, his arrow pointed in, I want 70s music. And then we just worked really, really hard to get what we wanted and to put things in there. And you're always just serving narrative and serving picture. But the most difficult thing of I, Tonya was getting people to understand that this was a really important story to be told. And, you know, Mark Knopfler was so gracious because he had turned down the Dire Straits song Romeo and Juliet several times, saying, no way. That was before I came on board. And then I reached out, spent 4 hours writing the right letter, sent it off, and sent him the first reel and said, I'm just asking you to take a look, and if you want to see the rest of it, let me know. And then I got a call from management and send the rest, and I knew that he would understand that was actually a really beautiful use of Romeo and Juliet.
So, what, do you like me?
You're so pretty.
No, I'm not.
struck Romeo. Sing the streets a serenade, laying everybody low.
Mm-hmm. And it was really great, but it was getting him. And then he wrote the sweetest note and said, "Thank you, Susan Jacobs. I would have never known." That was it. And he was so happy to be part of that film then. So I think it's really about communication, artist to artist, you know, what Craig's trying to do, why it's important, and why that music belongs there is a lot of it. And, you know, the same thing working on American Hustle or Silver Lining Playbook, which we had, you know, really early Alabama Shakes and very, very early Alt-J. Alt-J yep. was just a baby band at that point. It's so great when you realize that you're getting this great marriage of visuals and artists, and then also to see that. I was saying I went to see the most amazing ELO concert. They are out there playing. Jeff Lynne is playing the most amazing shows right now. And to see 10:05:38 Overture live just blew me up. So great, but I had a feeling like I bet American Hustle had a lot to do with putting that back in the playlist, because that guy's got one hit song after another. It's yeah. not like he, you know, but I bet that that's the influence of film. And you know, you kind of think, I bet that gave a lot of new life to that song, because the crowd went crazy over it. Crazy. Yeah.
It wasn't one of those, you know, top 20 ELO, you know, greatest hits. It definitely
was a deeper cut. No, he's got a top 40. Every song he plays, you can't believe, like, oh my God, he wrote that too, and he wrote that too, and he wrote that too. It's kind of amazing.
All right, I got one question for you. So you're the music geek like us, in terms of, you know, how does music work in the world, and obviously you're a big fan of music working in film and TV. Besides your own projects, what, if you had to say to anybody, give me an example of how music and audio and video can work together to create something, sort of a third thing that's the greater than the sum of the parts. What's your best example of that?
Go see Easy Rider. Go see The Graduate.
And here's to you, Mrs. Robinson. Jesus loves you more than you will know. Whoa, whoa, whoa. God bless you, please, Mrs. Robinson. Heaven holds a place for those who pray. Hey, hey, hey.
I mean, those are the things that all of us strive to make The Graduate again. Midnight Cowboy, my goodness. I mean, Harry Nilsson, you know, when you have that, especially Midnight Cowboy, when you have that collaboration between composer and then an artist like Harry, I mean, all of us are trying to keep making that. None of us have gotten there.
Everybody's talking at me. I don't hear words they're saying, only the echoes of my mind. People stop and stare, I can't see their faces, only the shadows of their eyes.
I think about Midnight Cowboy and how that soundtrack played to make that dark and deeper and more, you know, it's amazing. And you can't even look at The Graduate without thinking about the Simon and Garfunkel soundtrack to that.
Yeah.
We're all trying to do that. I mean, should I have anything that ever comes close to that kind of collaboration with a solo artist being able, but also the industry was braver then. I think people just took, you know, music played a looser role. It was more, you know, things weren't as managed as they are now.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think there's some young kid falling in love with your work now who's thinking the same thing. Someday I want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're inspiring a new generation there.
Oh, I hope so. I hope so.
We've been talking to Susan Jacobs, one of our favorite music supervisors. It's been a real pleasure, Susan. Thanks for coming on Sound Opinions.
Oh, great. Thank you all.
that wraps up our interview with music supervisor Susan Jacobs, and now we want to hear from you. What's a film or television show that you think uses music really well? Give us a call at 888-859-1800 and leave your answer and tell us why.
I tell you, little buddy, this whole island is bewitched.
Remember, we were shipwrecked together.
Stranded, I'm so far from home. Stranded, yeah, I'm on my own. Stranded, you gotta leave me alone. Cause I'm stranded on my own. Stranded, far from home.
As often as possible, we like to take a trip to the desert island, pop a quarter in the desert island jukebox, and play a track we cannot live without. Jim, this week it's your turn.
Well, Greg, obviously after that great chat we had with Susan, movies and music and the perfect pairing of the two were on my mind. I'm usually 2 or 3 years ahead of you on movies, but that's only because my wife is the editor of movies at your paper. She's often bringing something home, and she had to twist my arm to watch this film that she was excited about, and I was skeptical. Nico, 1988. This is a 2017 interesting collaboration between artists in Italy and Belgium. A female director, Susanna Nicorelli, shot in English, starring a Danish actress, Trine Dryholm. Apparently, Trine was a big star in her native Scandinavia, began singing as a teenager. The director, Susanna, and Trine, the actress, spent tons of time channeling late-era Nico. Now, Nico famously was the singer for the Velvet Underground on a few songs on the first album. Andy Warhol shoved her down John Cale and Lou Reed's throats. It resulted in moments of brilliance. She had a long solo career. There are moments of greatness in that solo career. But by 1988, when this film is almost entirely set, she was a heroin addict. She was bitter. She hated the idea that she was defined all these decades later by a couple of songs that she'd done in 1 year in her career early on. She resented the Warhol fame. She resented the Velvet Underground. But she needed to tour, especially in Europe, these sleazy punk clubs in order to buy heroin and pay her rent. You know, I saw Nico in that era. It was not pretty. It was sad. She was a haunted woman. You would not think this is an uplifting movie, but in many ways it captures the soul of a really complicated artist. And the music is delivered with passion by this woman who I don't know how she channels this one-of-a-kind, you know, Teutonic chanteuse from the netherworld, you know. Nico dies in a bike accident not long after the period in this movie ends. I'm going to go to one of her best songs that has become a huge classic in recent years thanks to its use in another movie. These Days was used with great effect by Wes Anderson in The Royal Tannenbaums. And then it started to, much like Hallelujah, it started to appear in soundtracks everywhere. These Days is now ubiquitous. A fascinating song. You know, it was written by a 16-year-old Jackson Brown, who comes from the West Coast, is bumming around New York, you know, the post-Dylan folky scene, hooks up with Nico romantically, gives her this great song. It's a song that kind of, you know, is hinting at the despair in her life before any of that stuff that happens over the next 3 decades that there was much to despair about. I've been out walking. I don't do that much talking these days, you know? It's a haunting, beautiful song. And this is the version from the movie with Trine Dryholm singing. You would think, man, it's tough to imitate Nico or better Nico. I think it's a beautiful version of the song. So These Days, the Nico song from the film Nico 1988.
I've been out walking. I don't do too much talking these days. to think a lot about the things that I forgot to do. And all the times I had the chance to, I've stopped my rambling. I don't do too much gambling these days. These days I seem to think about how all the changes came about my ways.
That is These Days by the actress Trine Dryholm from the film Nico, 1988. You got to catch up with it, Greg. Great movie.
That sounds spooky, Jim. And speaking of spooky, next week our show is Spooky Songs for Halloween. It's that time of year again. We're going to play some songs that are going to creep you out.
You can find every episode of Sound Opinions at soundopinions.org and subscribe to our podcast wherever you get those things. Sound Opinions was produced by Brendan Banizak, Alex Claiborne, Ayanna Contreras, and Andrew Gill.
And if I seem to be afraid to live the life that I have made in song.
Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So now it's time to hear what you have to say.
Hello, this is Ryan from Portland, Oregon. I wanted to tell you about a band, Buried Treasure, that I'm just absolutely in love with right now. A band called Savila from here in Portland. Three-piece, guitar, drums, vocals, and they have this amazing blend of kind of Latin rhythms and some really, really cool guitar sounds. It's vocals in English and vocals in Spanish, and they're just one of the most truly exciting bands I've seen in a long time. I saw them open for La Luz a few months ago, and I've just been completely obsessed ever since. First record was self-released. It's just maybe like a month ago. So give it a look, give it a listen. It's really, really amazing, and I really hope the world catches up with these guys. So check it out. Thank you.
Hi, this is Teresa Jones from St. Pete, Florida, and I love you guys' show. And I just wondered if you had a chance to listen to Greta Van Fleet out of Frankenmuth, Michigan. Three brothers and a drummer that are bringing back a new, fresh outlook on classic rock and roll. Have a new CD out, Anthem of a Peaceful Army. Give it a listen, and thank you for all you do.
Hey, Jim and Greg, this is Greg from Las Vegas. I'm wondering, what do you think about the new F***ed Up record, man? Super layered, and you know, I don't know, man. Anyways, you're part of my weekend. I listen with my cat Yolo, and keep it up. Love the show.
Hi, Jim and Greg. This is Brad in Logan Square. I'm in the middle of the Disco and Seymour Stein episode number 668, and got about halfway through the Disco segment. I couldn't even make it through the whole episode because there's things going on in Disco that are not about the music. You want to say like working class or just like, you know, Rust Belt, Middle America, the images and the clothing that go along with these discos. People can't afford those clothes. You're not going to relate to, like, the environment of what a disco might be.
We won't settle for less. Don't be a drag. Participate. Clamps on the half shell and roller skates. Roller skates.
You know, I guess that's where I see the attitude of the disco demolition sort of like coming from. I think it's a negative point of view, and I think it is destructive. So that is problematic. But at the same time, I think there needs to be a recognition that this was a genre and a form that like just didn't connect with a lot of America. Thanks for doing what you do, guys. Catch you next time. See you next time. Bye.
No more messages.
To share your opinions on Sound Opinions, call 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.